This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Angle.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the MMQB Podcast. This is week 14. Let us know what you want to see in the show. You can tweet me at InglesAngle on Twitter or at Andy_Benoit. Later on, we'll have an interview with Buffalo Bills defensive end Jerry Hughes. Andy spoke with him earlier this week, and we're looking forward to getting to that. Andy, did all of your Thanksgiving dreams come true?
Yeah,
did you keep the remote away from your family?
I did, yeah. And we'll spare the people the details, but it was tumultuous. I had some ornery cousins. They walked up to the box and hit the box without, and it made the game jump to live late in the fourth quarter.
Oh, that pissed me off.
Yeah, it was the Eagles Cowboys. Fortunately, I was in the hallway, not in the room, and so everybody yelled, "Don't come in!" And it was nice they looked out for me like that. But if they were really looking out for me, they would have just gone upstairs and chatted with everybody instead of trying to watch a game that they have no understanding of anyway. I mean, they don't follow football.
Great games last week. The Patriots are coming off a loss, and the Chargers coming off that huge win over the Ravens to get to 8-4 and just one game away from that lead in the AFC. Andy, we'll start right here. Make a case that the Chargers are for real in the AFC now.
Well, it starts with their quarterback. He's obviously for real, Phillip Rivers. And I think after watching him against Baltimore and the way he commanded that game at the line of scrimmage, you know, Rivers does more at the line of scrimmage than every QB in the league other than Peyton Manning. And it might even be as much as Peyton Manning. And they operate out of a no-huddle there. And he is excellent. Rivers is excellent with protection adjustments, recognizing coverages, route adjustments, I'd say. So that makes them for real right there, because when you have a QB at that kind of level, we're talking elite quarterback stuff, and he was elite versus Baltimore, then all of a sudden your offensive line is going to be maximizing its success because you're going to hide its weaknesses. Your receivers maximize their success, and if you get really good, your running game opens up because teams do what they do to Manning and the Broncos, and that's tend to keep their safeties back.
Phillip Rivers, one of the two winningest quarterbacks in the final four games of the season, too. So we're talking December.
Over his career?
All time.
Okay. Winningest quarterback. In his career of all time.
Sure, you know what number two is in winning percentage in the final four games of a regular season?
What his winning percentage is. Is that what you're asking?
No, his winning percentage is like .893, something
okay.
in that
Okay, is
range.
That number one or two?
That's one.
Oh, okay, I thought you said that was two.
Now, number two is who he's facing this week, Tom Brady. Two very
really?
Different quarterbacks.
That's a good nugget, man. You did your homework for this show.
I'll have to credit the San Diego Chargers Twitter feed for that one.
That's the kind of thing those teams find. Have you ever read like a team media guide?
They're like 30-0 in sub 26 degree.
Every team's golden in those media guides. That's one case for San Diego being for real. What else has impressed me about the Chargers, and not so much this week because Baltimore did have success against them, but conceptually, this as a whole, their defense, as we talked about on the show a few weeks ago, has gotten healthier, and it's a better defense. And I'm waiting for Melvin Ingram to make a splash, but I think he will because he tends to do that. He's an outstanding talent. Brandon Flowers owned Steve Smith last week. So if you have a guy like that, he followed Smith around. Now, that may have been a case of they felt that he matched up well to Smith. My guess is they also felt that Sharice Wright needed to be hidden and therefore on Torrey Smith, not Steve Smith. Now, the negative, of course, is Sharice Wright proved to be a liability. But if they can, you can give Sharice Wright safety help. And if you have Brandon Flowers as a true number one corner now, that's a whole different formula than we've seen this season for the Chargers.
How much do you see Tom Brady picking at Sharice Wright there? Because he hasn't just been a liability this game. You've seen Sharice Wright issues throughout the season.
Yeah, Sharice Wright, I know you and I have talked off the air and that you don't like Sharice Wright.
Well, we both said he's the most average cornerback in the league, maybe below average.
He's below average this week. I mean, he had a very bad game, and I say, obviously, 1 week does not make a guy go below average, but in his case, he'll go well below average, and then he'll jump up and be above average, and he'll go back and forth. He's an inconsistent cornerback, and he has the tools. I like that he's lanky. I think he works in a cover three scheme, but when they play man-to-man, and that's what they did more often, especially early in the game against Baltimore, when they do that, I'm not sure Sharice Wright's that kind of a player. You asked if Tom Brady would go after him. Absolutely. Tom Brady he'll go into games targeting specific cornerbacks. Now, the question is, does Brady right now at this point have the type of receivers that can attack Sharice Wright, because most of what New England does is between the numbers, not outside the numbers.
Well, and against the Packers, we saw a Patriots offense that was almost completely revolving around Gronk, Brandon LaFell, and Julian Edelman. So there weren't a ton of options for him to go to.
But that's not the worst thing. I mean, you just named their three best receivers, and they were a passing offense. And their running game, boy, it's interesting that Jonas Gray hasn't played, isn't it?
Well, and we had that question, would they go to the power running game that worked in that one game with Jonas Gray?
Well, against Indianapolis. And I'm not surprised that they haven't stuck with it, because the Patriots are, as everybody knows, very much a team, you know, a week-by-week team. Their game plans will change based on the opponent. And for this week, I think we'll see a balanced approach that leans more towards the running game again. You know, something else, New England's been very good with play action, which I love, because that's you marry the running game and the passing game there. And I would expect them to do some play action against San Diego to try to manipulate those safeties. Eric Weddle's not necessarily a guy you can fool, but he does play rangy, and you can try to manipulate him still with what he's seeing out there. And then also play action can help draw one-on-one matchups on the perimeter. And so a guy like Brandon LaFell, that's where you do get your chance to go after Sharice Wright.
So then what's a reason that this Chargers team isn't for real then? Would it be the offensive line, or is it the ability to manipulate a defense?
You're asking me to talk both sides of the aisle now?
Both coins.
Well, a reason they would not be for real is all the guys were – I mean, obviously, we just talked about Sharice Wright. They do have some holes on defense, and the guys, some of these, you know, it's a very good defense, but they don't always play that way. I'm thinking of a guy like, for example, Donald Butler, who I think is a very good player. He can disappear at times, which is unusual for him, and he's done that more as of late. The pass rush is very inconsistent for San Diego. They're almost at the point, in fact, I'd say, because Ingram has not exploded yet, and he might not. I think he will, but since he hasn't, they're at the point where they still have to manufacture a pass rush. So they have to blitz, they have to do zone exchanges, extra stunt concepts, whatever it is, because they just don't have the bodies anymore.
Is there anything to worry about with New England coming off that loss to Green Bay? Now that defense has to deal with Keenan Allen, who's coming off a great game, Antonio Gates, as always. Is there anything you worry about moving forward?
Not really. I think they ran into a Packer team on the road that's a really good team, and they got the short end of the stick on that one. I mean, it was a well-played game by both sides, and obviously you could see by Tom Brady's demeanor on the sideline, he felt that it was an opportunity to win. He felt it was a winnable game, but I thought that matchup against the Packers really came down to the other side of the ball, and the way Aaron Rodgers was able to make plays with some of his best receivers getting stifled in man coverage.
Davante Adams was great for him when Jordy Nelson was taken away, and even Randall Cobb.
He was, and that didn't surprise me. Adams is a very good player, very talented, and if you give him a week of practice where you tell him you're going to be the guy, and they certainly told him that because they knew that Browner and Revis and some combination of a safety help with those two would take away Cobb and Nelson, so they knew that the guy left to have the favorable matchups would be Davante Adams. So if you tell that guy all week long, you're the guy and here's how we're going to use you, and you practice exactly how you're going to use him, he can rise up to that occasion. He can now, his key, and we're talking Packers now, I guess, but real quickly, Davante Adams, a guy like that, his key is being able to rise up at the drop of a hat and rise up at a moment's notice in any scenario, not just where the game plan centers around him. But that's another story for another time. I hope we see the Packers and Patriots play again. Not just because it's my Super Bowl pick, but because I can't wait. I would love to see how they play them a second time. My guess is New England would do exactly the same thing they did in this last game and just trust that they could maybe get more of a natural pass rush.
Let's hop over to the NFC and two teams coming off very convincing road wins there on Thanksgiving. This is another playoff implication contest, and the most intriguing side of the ball in this matchup has to be Eagles offense versus that top-ranked Seahawks defense.
Yes, no question about it, because that Seahawks defense is coming back to life. And they had injuries at some key spots, at their number two and even number three cornerback spots, at strong safety with Cam Chancellor not himself for most of the year, at middle linebacker at Bobby Wagner out for five games. Those guys are all back. Now, they're missing Brandon Meebane, but you know, it looks like they're surviving with Kevin Williams at the nose shade. Not a bad veteran to plug in. I mean, he's going to understand the techniques because he's, even though he hasn't played the position, he's been around forever. So it looks like they're surviving on their defensive line, and they're really thriving at the rest of their spots. With Wagner at 100% and Chancellor at 100%, this is an extremely fast defense. And they play fast out of their zone responsibilities in the middle of the field. They essentially shrink the field with their speed. And it'll be interesting to watch how they choose to match up to the Eagles, because the Eagles are one of the few offenses in the league that might be able to take Seattle out of that cover three hybrid zone comfort zone that they have, no pun intended. But when they play with those cornerbacks on the outside pressing and jamming the wide receivers, and then they play zone inside with these fast guys I'm talking about, and they can run around the field, that's when they're at their best. That's their forte. I don't know if you can necessarily just play zone on the outside against Philadelphia, for one, because they do a lot of unbalanced trips formations. They'll put three receivers to one side and only a tight end to the other. And that tight end won't even be detached from the formation. He'll be up on the line of scrimmage. So they widen one side of the field and shorten the other side. And that kind of thing can be hard to play press coverage against on the boundaries, on the outside. So I wouldn't be surprised if Philadelphia does a lot of that, and Seattle's going to have to respond to it.
Having a healthy Byron Maxwell, though, back there in the mold for Seattle, like you wrote earlier this week, is very helpful in trying to accomplish that on those outside zones with your cornerbacks.
Yeah, they can play those outside zones because Maxwell is back. And when he was out, you know, I want to give credit. Those backup cornerbacks, Simon and Burley, did a very good job while they were in there.
We thought depth would be a real issue for them without Maxwell in the lineup.
Well, a little bit. I mean, I wasn't, honestly, John, I wasn't shocked by it because I think those guys are extremely well coached in Seattle, and those cornerbacks can get ready quickly, even if they're lower round guys, because of the techniques they teach there. But yeah, obviously, if you're playing undrafted or low drafted youngsters, guys that haven't been on the field, especially opposite of Richard Sherman, so you know the ball's going their way more often. Yeah, that's a concern, but they weathered that storm. And now they're back. But I don't think Maxwell, while he's very good on the perimeter, and in fact, he's been playing the slot more lately as well. And I think that's a good thing, because he's going to have to play inside. Someone's going to have to play inside against Philadelphia. I don't think the Eagle or the Seahawks can just keep their cornerbacks outside and expect to match up that way, because the formations are not going to allow it. And Denver did a lot of this in the Super Bowl to try to make Seattle uncomfortable, and what they wound up doing was at times just matching personnel and putting a cornerback on a certain receiver. And I think we'll see them do that again, and my guess is Sherman will take Macklin, and Riley Cooper will be guarded by Byron Maxwell.
We talk about this every single week, but it has to be said. Hopping over to the other side of the ball, what do the Eagles have to do to contain Russell Wilson?
You have to spy him. You have to put some kind of eyes on him, because right now, as it stands, you could very well make the argument that aside from a good running game, I don't think it's a great running game, but aside from a good Seahawks running game, that offense has nothing except for Russell Wilson's movement skills. Watch the film. Just don't even watch the games. Just watch their games, and you can see that a small number, by NFL standards, a small number of their pass completions actually come within the design structure of the play, meaning Wilson drops back or rolls out and throws it right on time. A large, large number of their completions come out of structure, where Wilson runs around and makes something happen and things break down. And that's how he killed the 49ers. So as a defense, you have to take away those out of structure plays, or maybe more realistically, you have to just minimize them.
Did the 49ers go to a spy? Because Russell Wilson only ended up with 35 yards on the ground. Granted, the Seahawks did have a large margin of a lead for most of that game, but did they go with the spy?
Yes, they did. In certain third down scenarios, they spied Wilson. And actually, the guy they did it with was Ahmad Brooks, which is interesting because usually a spy comes from the middle of the field. Brooks is an edge player, so they had to get to some of the spy techniques out of different looks in different ways. The other thing they did that kept Wilson's numbers on the ground low is they defended the read option really well and forced Wilson to hand the ball off. And so that probably took away 20 of his usual rushing yards.
Wouldn't that be the reason to keep the spy on the outside, though? Because Russell Wilson is always rolling out. Why would you keep a spy on Russell Wilson in the middle of the field?
Yeah, no, I was thinking that as I was saying it, and the answer that popped in my head is, which side do you choose, though?
That's
obviously
true.
The Niners chose Ahmad Brooks. But yeah, because Wilson is extremely good throwing on the move to his left. That's why he's a borderline superstar, because he can throw on the move in either direction. There's not a better passer on the move to his left than Russell Wilson.
Those baseball skills, man.
It might
middle
be.
Middle infielder.
I mean, he has such great upper body control. That's his greatest strength, and it's the ability to make deep touch passes, or really touch, which I know sounds weird, deep touch passes, but they're touch passes that can stretch 20, 25 yards. He can throw them 5 to 10 yards, of course, but he has such a repertoire passing abilities out of that look. And so it's going to be, you know, who's going to be critical, I think, in this game, and actually who's been critical for the Eagles in recent weeks and why the defense has been pretty good overall this year. I don't know what the numbers say, but I like the Eagles defense on film. Those safeties, Nate Allen, who's been better, and he's been able to even play man coverage at times, and Malcolm Jenkins, the free agent pickup, who we know can play man coverage because he came in the league as a cornerback. Those guys are interchangeable. They can do what the other can do and flip-flop and all that stuff, and that's been great for Bill Davis, defensive coordinator, because he likes to do a lot of things, and people like me tend to think of Bill Davis as a blitzing coordinator. This year, the Eagles have done a little bit more with coverage concepts than with blitzes.
Are the Seattle wide receivers still having trouble getting separation like we've talked about throughout this podcast throughout the year?
Yeah, they are. They're having trouble. I mean, that San Francisco game was not a great offensive output by either team. The Seahawks just dominated with their defense, but the Niners also defeated Seattle's offense.
The team Seattle is chasing right now, the Cardinals, who sit atop the NFC West at 9-3, have lost 2 straight now. Are the Cardinals' problems these last 2 games micro issues, or is this a grander problem that we need to look at moving forward?
I think it's grander now because of Andre Ellington's health is now in question, and you have Drew Stanton in there, and I think Stanton has been fine, but only fine, and nothing more than fine, because the Cardinals in the last 2 weeks, going up against a good Seahawks defense 2 weeks ago, a great Seahawks defense, but a very average at best Falcons defense, they still did the same thing. They only put up 3 meaningful points. I know that they scored 18 against Atlanta, but 7 of those came off of a defensive touchdown for the Cardinals, and then they had some garbage points at the end of the games. For all intents and purposes, they scored 3 meaningful points against the Falcons. And the Falcons did a lot to them. They threw a lot at Drew Stanton, and they played man coverage. And when you come in with that kind of an aggressive game plan, that's something that Mike Nolan, the D coordinator, will do. But I also get the sense that's something that a lot of defensive coordinators will do now against Arizona, because it seemed like that was the best way to play them, to attack them rather than react to them. And Atlanta was able to play man coverage, and that's why they were able to do all those pressure things. Kansas City, in this very highly ranked Chiefs defense, this Chiefs pass defense, also has man-to-man defenders. In fact, much better ones than the Falcons, who are really a zone-based team. The Chiefs are equipped to throw a lot at Drew Stanton, just like the Falcons did. And the other part of it, it's not just throwing it at Drew Stanton. It's attacking the interior offensive line for Arizona, which is one of the least athletic interior offensive lines in the league.
Yeah, I was going to say, outside of the great ability to play that man coverage, the pass rush has been incredible for the Chiefs this season with Tom Bahaly and Justin Houston.
And I would think now we're going to see stunts and A-gap blitzes from them, which means they'll be standing up on third downs, moving around. They won't just be at wide nine position or rushing off the edge. I think we're going to see them move around, and I would be surprised if they don't both come off the same side of the ball a few times, if they don't both line up near each other more than once.
Who do you see being used in those double A gaps? Is that
I think
Houston?
It'll be or Holly. I think it could be either one, and it could also just be Kansas City's regular defenders too. They have, they can blitz. They know how to blitz. But if I were the Chiefs, I would put my if I'm Bob Sutton, their D coordinator, I would put my best pass rushers inside along with each other and try to dare and force the Cardinals to block me with either Lyle Sinline, who frankly he struggled in pass protection last week, and he's kind of been an up and down player like that throughout his career, or Ted Larson or Jonathan Cooper, who got reps now last week as well.
The Chiefs aren't the only team with a good pass rush in this game either. So how does Alex Smith adjust to the pressure concepts that come at him from Arizona?
Well, it's going to have to be Andy Reid doing the work there, defining the reads for Smith, and it's a chess match there. And Andy Reid employed Todd Bowles during his final year, Reid's final year in Philadelphia. So I would imagine he's a little bit aware of what Bowles does. Now, Bowles was a different kind of coach with the Eagles. He did not run the defense the way he has in Arizona schematically with all these blitzes and stuff. But Andy Reid still knows the way Bowles thinks about things, and Bowles is known as a micro thinker. He thinks about one play at a time. And I would think Reid will have specific responses to a lot of those one play at a times that Bowles shows him. It's going to have to be on Reid, because Alex Smith is not going to line up and just kill the Cardinals for blitzing him. He's not that kind of quarterback.
The analytical guys will point to the stats that say that Alex Smith is terrible when pressured and his ability drops tremendously. But he does have wins against good pass rushes in Miami, St. Louis, New York, and Buffalo. That was a good win for the Chiefs.
Yeah.
Are those stats maybe misleading then about Alex Smith?
Here's why I think the stats could be. I don't think they are, because Alex Smith is not a strong-armed guy. He's mobile, so he runs away from guys, and maybe you get some of that on pressure, although a lot of pressure also eliminates that facet of a quarterback's approach. They force a quarterback to stay in the pocket if they're really well-designed pressure schemes. What I would say to that is Alex Smith's receivers are not very good, and none of those guys separate against man coverage. And when you blitz, you're almost always playing man coverage behind it, because that's part of how the blitz design works. The idea of a blitz is to force the ball to come out quickly, and if you're doing that, you want to be in man-to-man right up on the receiver, so you're there when the ball arrives, rather than back in zone where there's still a 3 or 4 yard buffer zone. Nothing's worse than watching a cornerback play off coverage behind a blitz, because the two concepts negate one another. So the Chiefs are probably getting bump and run press type coverage on those blitzes that Alex Smith is seeing, and you tell me which of his receivers are going to consistently win in those scenarios.
Since doing this podcast with you, whenever I think Todd Bowles, the first thing that pops up is double A gap blitz. What else does he throw at an offensive line? Is it only really that look?
No, it's a lot more than that look. There's triple A gap blitz, actually, where he brings the safety behind both those blitzers. He's been doing more stuff with some of the B gap looks lately. It's not always just double A gap. Sometimes it's just one guy in the A gap and then having a B gap, a three technique next to him or somewhere in relation to him. It's all about manipulating the way blockers have to behave. And when you have guys up in the A gaps, and it sometimes can just be one A gap filled, then you force the center to block him, because the center can't just ignore a guy in the A-gap. Otherwise, he runs the risk of giving the blitzer the cleanest and easiest path to the quarterback. It's the last thing you can have on offense. So a center has to react to it, and that's what Bowles does. He tries to manipulate your center, and then he attacks you based on how your center is going to respond.
And a lot of that comes in bluffing too, right?
You can play
with the quarterback.
All the center has to do is see the pressure to react to it. He has to react to it. And it's why the center's the guy they attack, is because often what the center does dictates how the other guys play or what they do schematically with other guys. So it's a good chess match thing, and we're going to see a lot of it in this game, because both of these teams are designed to win off of manufactured big plays like this.
We know the Steelers and Dick LeBeau love to do those kinds of bluffing blitzes too, and all four AFC North teams this week have big important games. And before we dive into the Browns and the Manziel stuff and that whole fiasco with Brian Hoyer, let's hit the only AFC North matchup, which is head-to-head. Steelers-Bengals. Both quarterbacks in this game have been inconsistent over the last 4 weeks, with extreme highs and lows when you bring in Andy Dalton and Ben Roethlisberger throwing for 12 touchdowns in 2 weeks.
And then looking very bad at times in the weeks following that, including the first half of last week's game.
Yeah, so since throwing 6 touchdowns, Roethlisberger has 4 total touchdown passes over the last 3 weeks. So he had those back-to-back sixes.
Yeah, he cooled off a little bit. He's also missed some throws. He doesn't leave throws on the field too much. He's pretty good about spotting who's open, in part because he can hold the ball and wait for guys to get open. But he was off target on way too many balls against the Saints.
Especially to Heath Miller. I even noticed that in that first half, a lot of overthrows on those short and intermediate routes.
And he overthrew Le'Veon Bell on one. The interception to Darius Hayward-Bey was an inaccurate throw, and not to mention a poor decision to throw into coverage, double coverage. He wasn't good in that half. I'm sure he would tell you that. He came out sharper in the second half, and that was against the Saints did a ton of zones, too high zone coverage. They also played man-to-man out of too high, so two-man coverage. But what the Steelers did at halftime to adjust was widen the field. They went with wider splits for their receivers and spread sets. And what that did was widen the Saints' zones. And therefore, the receivers were then able to sit down in the zone and catch balls rather than move through the zones to catch balls. And so Roethlisberger's accuracy issues were curtailed for that. Now, that's a halftime adjustment kind of thing. I don't know if that means they're going to come out against Cincinnati and widen the formations again like that. They might. I mean, the Bengals have been a coverage-based team lately as well. In fact, I would be surprised if they don't play the exact same formula that the Saints played. I mean, I wrote that in the MMQB piece this week before I saw the Steeler film. I got lucky there because I didn't know the Saints had played too high against the Steelers until I watched the tape after that. But I thought the Bengals heading into this game before even seeing how New Orleans did, I thought they would play Iloka and Reggie Nelson over the top against these Steeler receivers because Cincinnati had success with that against Tampa Bay, and doing that is the way to take away the deep ball, and the Steelers really live and die on the deep ball.
Will the Bengals have any trouble without having that pass rush? The pass rush hasn't been great this season. Do you think that Iloka and Nelson can keep this going, having that too high safety help?
I do. I think because two high safeties don't get beat very often. Usually when you play two, where if you're going to get beat out of a two high safety look, usually it's going to be underneath the deep intermediate levels. A linebacker is going to get exposed before your safety gets exposed. Now, the Bengals, you know, no team has linebackers that can play man coverage or even zone coverage for 6 seconds. I mean, it's just not going to work that way, and the Bengals are no exception. So they're going to have to get some kind of pass rush. You can't be a team that doesn't rush the passer. I think Cincy's pass rush is better than the numbers. I know their sacks are low, and it hasn't been a great pass rush this year. But watching that Bucs game, Dunlap had all kinds of pressure throughout the game. It didn't register sacks, but it still impacted the game. And you have Geno Atkins inside, who's not himself circa 2012 yet, but he's still a far and away above average defensive tackle. Now, you know, Tampa Bay's offensive line is also the worst in the league, so maybe that was why the Bengals look good lately. But what I'm getting at is they have the personnel. It's not like they can't play.
It seems like people think that the Bengals are kind of in the driver's seat now in that AFC North.
They are. I mean, if they win out.
Yeah, well, they play the Steelers twice, and they still have the Broncos and a road game against Cleveland. That doesn't seem like the driver's seat.
No, well, it's because the Steelers are also in the driver's seat. If the Steelers win out, then they'll win the division.
Huh?
Yeah, because they'll play the Bengals twice. So I love that, and the NFL is so smart about scheduling because the way they do it, multiple teams now control their own destiny within the same division.
They manipulate us, that
NFL.
Yeah.
I'm fine with it. I mean,
it's
humans
fun.
Are meant
We're
to
victims.
Be manipulated. This is look, if they're going to do this good of a job, they can do whatever they want. I'm fine with it.
That Steelers defense is starting to get healthier, too. Maybe we'll see it here, but it hasn't really shown up on the field yet, right?
As far as being healthier, being better because they're
healthier. Performing better because of the health.
It did not last week. I mean, Ike Taylor came back and gave up two huge plays, two touchdowns. He was very good on all the other plays, but as someone on Twitter pointed out to me, saying he's very good in all the other plays is like saying a pitcher gave up two grand slams but was very good in all the
True.
Other. It's a little, I would say it's like two home runs because grand slams, you have to let guys on base a bunch. But I get the analogy. Ike Taylor can't give up big plays like that.
And they've only gotten one turnover in the last 3 weeks.
And that's been their problem. When the Steelers have been bad over the years, or just actually, they're never bad, but when they've been very average, they haven't been forcing turnovers. And we saw that again last week. And something else, the Saints did not fear the Steelers' pass rush almost at all. They did a ton of deep intermediate route combinations with 7-step drops for Drew Brees. When was it that we would ever go into a game thinking the opposing team's going to have a game plan centered around no fear of the Steelers' pass rush?
That's crazy. It just doesn't even
make sense.
It's
not Steeler football. Now, Cincinnati might be a different story because I don't know if you want Dalton on a 7-step drop. He's more of a timing rhythm passer, not that Breeze isn't, but you trust the later in the down it goes, the more you trust Breeze rather than the more you trust Dalton.
Well,
so, you know, and Dalton also has some inconsistent mechanic issues. He, you know, we know what Andy Dalton is, and we've seen the inconsistencies last week where he was awful in the first half, very good in the second half. I don't think you put the game plan entirely in his lap.
Sticking in the AFC North, Mike Pettine has put our Johnny Manziel fever to rest temporarily. Brian Hoyer will be the starter. You didn't think it would go that way.
I was 100% sure, I was, I guess it was 99.5%, that it would be Manziel because of what Pettine said after the game last week, where he talked to Sal Palantonio.
Like, no job is safe kind of thing.
Well, and saying that this has been on the table for weeks. We've been having discussions. I couldn't believe he said that. I thought, okay, he's posturing. He's getting ahead of the curve here for all the fallout for the Manziel decision. That is, I figured the decision had been made, and Pettine was just hedging his bet and saying, you know, laying the seeds for why Hoyer was benched. But that wasn't the case. I guess they're sticking with Brian Hoyer. That really, really surprises me because of how they handled it. Now, also, watching the film, I could see why someone would want to go to Manziel. I don't know if that's the right answer. I understand sticking with Hoyer. I actually kind of like the decision. But I can see why you would make the decision to do Manziel, because he was much better against the Bills, and his mobility was a positive factor at times, whereas Hoyer, he's not making clean reads right now. He's leaving guys on the field. He's throwing where he shouldn't be throwing. He's predetermining throws. He's being a bad quarterback right now.
62 of 120 the last 3 weeks.
Completion out of attempts?
Yeah.
Yep, and one of those was a 20 out of 50 against Houston, which was actually one of his better games in the last 3 weeks.
That's scary.
Seriously.
The 20 out of 50 can be one of your better games.
Yeah, and partly because it wasn't his fault always on the 20 out of 50. The whole passing game was out of sync for a variety of reasons. But, you know, the problem, John, is that Cleveland doesn't have a rushing attack. And just like we said that Pittsburgh's pass rush was not feared and that impacted how the Saints game planned, teams are game planning to play too high coverage against the Browns and not even think twice about it. And it's very what that too high coverage is doing is it's limiting some of the route combinations they can do. I think it's impacting their crossing route game out of rollouts and bootlegs, where Hoyer was at his best on play action bootlegs and rollout stuff earlier in the year. They haven't done that as much. And I think it's my guess, and I don't know. I'm eager to talk to these coaches after the season, these Brown coaches. My guess is they are doing this in response to some of the defensive looks that they're getting.
What has the Josh Gordon impact been so far on that offense? Has it changed at all in Cleveland?
Well, you can see that Gordon's a great player. I mean,
clearly.
Yeah, I mean, and we can see why they would want to force the ball to him. I haven't gotten the sense. I watched it. Yeah, it's a different approach on offense. I don't know if it's negatively hurting them, and I haven't seen it positively help them yet. Although at the end of that Atlanta game, Gordon made some big plays for them, and Hoyer was phenomenal in that final drive. So that's the kind of thing you don't necessarily get out of other guys who, you know, the guys who aren't Josh Gordon.
Will anything change about the way the Colts have been playing defense this season when they take on the Browns?
The man-to-man stuff, I think they'll play more two-man. I don't see why
just
they
like
would.
Just like everyone else.
Yeah, I don't see why they would treat it. I mean, the Colts of all teams should know about the perils of not having a running game, what that does to help a defense out. So it's now their chance to get to play Trent Richardson's former team.
Yeah, exactly.
I had to get Richardson's name in there, so I hate to rag on the guy, but
Mr. 2.5 yards per carry.
I'm telling you, folks, if you're a fantasy owner, just pick up Heron, their backup running back, because he's going to become their starter before the year's over.
Fantasy football advice.
Yeah.
That's new.
And just in time for the playoffs, the season's about to end, but I saved it for when no one could use the advice.
You're like a Swiss Army knife for football, Andy.
Oh, you think?
So many
options. Dull one on fantasy.
The Colts haven't beat a winning team since week 8. Can you believe that?
Well, what are we in? Week 14? That's a little wide.
That's
how many winning teams have they played, though?
They've played Washington, Jacksonville, lost to New England, beat New York. I mean, New York's.
Which I guess it doesn't matter. But which,
Giants.
Yeah, that's
Giants.
Right. Okay, of course. I was
Everyone's
it was a Monday night
Giants.
Game, of course. I remember that. That was the game that the pass rush was dominant. Well, so what? I mean, they haven't played winning teams.
That's true. I guess it's not their fault then.
But I think your thing holds true for the whole year, doesn't it? Your little stat there? Read off who they won against, their wins against.
They've beat Jacksonville, Tennessee, Baltimore's a good win, Houston, killed Cincinnati, remember that game, the shutout.
Yep.
Lost to Pittsburgh, beat New York, lost to New England, beat Jacksonville again, beat Washington.
So
beat
the losses, up on some bad teams. Go over the losses real quick.
Losses were to Denver, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and New England.
Denver, that's a pretty good lineup of teams, isn't it? So to me, that suggests the Colts are second class, not first class, if third class is average.
Rounding out the AFC North teams with a matchup that could ultimately prove to be win-in, loser-out kind of scenario, the Ravens are traveling to Miami. Two good defenses here. Big numbers hung up on them last week, though. We talked about Miami's defense after the Denver game last week. Now, what about the Ravens defense? It surrendered 34 points at home to the Chargers, which ended up being a loss.
Yeah, that was a bad loss. That was a home loss to a team that you had down by, I think it was 15 or something like that, 14. There's two clear touchdowns.
The Chargers were leading for less than 30 seconds that game.
In the whole game, yeah.
Whole game.
So you blew a lead if you're Baltimore. And their secondary got exposed in that one. And we've kind of been waiting for that because they've had some personnel changes at the cornerback spot. As we know, they've changed your number two and number three corner. They're trying to figure out what to do in the slot to the point where they're even playing Matt Elam in the slot. Matt Elam's a safety. He's not a slot cornerback. And Elam can't get on the field at their regular safety spot. Will Hill has supplanted him, which isn't the worst thing because Will Hill is extremely – he's as talented as probably all but seven or eight safeties in the league. So Will Hill, when his head is screwed on straight, is an excellent player. But they've even put in Jeremy Miles at their other safety spot ahead of Darian Stewart, which was a change I didn't see coming because Miles is one of those street free agent guys. And Stewart was that as well, but he'd been starting for them, and I thought he played okay. He wasn't good against New Orleans, though. It says a lot of – I mean, we're in December. Listen to all these personnel changes that we're talking about. And as I said, yeah, Jeremy Miles, we can't – you know, you can't be having this at this time of year. You're going to get exploited with all that.
It seems like the shuffle at defensive back that the Jets started the season off with. Remember that? Safeties are playing corner,
yeah.
Corners are playing safety. It was just a mess.
Yeah, and now Baltimore's finding that. Now, the different – you know, actually, the way they're similar is that they both teams have really good players up front. Baltimore has an offense that can mask the issues, and that's why they're winning and the Jets are losing for the most part. But – if you're asking how do we, and you're not, but if you are, if you're asking how to bet on Baltimore and why that I don't think these secondary issues are necessarily a lightning, you know, a rod through their chest, I don't think it's going to kill them, is because they have Haloti Ngata, they have Chris Canty's back and he's playing well. Terrell Suggs is still at his highest level. Doomerville's still Doomerville. Mosley's a star. Daryl Smith's a top 15 inside linebacker, maybe top 20, probably top 15. And Courtney Upshaw's an excellent player. That's seven guys, to say nothing of Pernell McPhee off the bench or Timmy Jernigan, who's very good. This might be the best front seven in terms of just raw talent in the NFL. And they employ these guys, all of them, in a variety of different ways. They can do multiple looks and different types of fronts with them. So it's a dangerous Baltimore team that Miami's going up against.
Well, and they don't have to worry about the kind of read option look that they'll see from Ryan Tannehill anymore. That sort of disappeared.
You and this Tannehill read option, like, you just love it.
When they
Tannehill
went to it, it worked, and then it's disappeared the last 4 weeks. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, no, but John, it didn't disappear against the Jets. It showed up. Remember, he had several read options that, and he took them inside, which was different. He went up this, I guess, is about the C gap with them rather than around the edge. I don't think it's disappeared. I think teams are very dialed in on it. We haven't seen the 30-yard runs out of the read option, but no play is designed to get a 30-yard run. Where we've still seen the 12-yard gains, and that's, you know, every team will take that. Every offense will have that.
The last AFC matchup with playoff implications is the Bills and Broncos. Before we get to the conversation with Jerry Hughes, you spoke with him just a couple of days ago. Andy, assess Buffalo's chances of coming away from this game 8-5 against Peyton Manning and the all-glorious Denver Broncos.
The chances are not good, but better than bad.
And, okay.
Yeah, and the
I'll
reason
live with it.
Yeah, the reason why is because, all right, the formula for beating Denver is you want to control the clock a little bit on offense, like we saw the Rams in that run-based approach do. And with Kyle Orton there, you can do that in Buffalo. In fact, that offense is designed to be a matriculate the ball downfield type of offense. They're not going to gash you for a couple 35-yard gains in a game. They'll do that, but that's not what they're built on. So I think the offense can sustain. If they can sustain, they got the guys to do it. But defensively, it might be the best defense in the league. And I know I'm the guy that said Miami a few weeks ago. Since I said that, Miami has not played very well, and Buffalo's played great. Things change. You know, Miami's not the best defense forever, or I was wrong on that. Whatever it is, Buffalo's playing extremely – I don't care. Buffalo's playing extremely well right now. And they can do a lot of stuff. And we saw them go cover two zone against the Browns all game long. I don't think they can do that against Manning. I do think they need to go back to more of the disguises that they did earlier in the year, zone exchange, pass rush stuff. You can't give Manning the same static look all game, and you certainly don't want to line up and just play man coverage against him and not blitz. So I think they got to change it up more, and I'm curious to see how that goes. If they can do that successfully, maybe force a turnover or two out of it, they'll be in the game. It'll be a close game.
And do you think that will stem because of the pressure that guys like Jerry Hughes and that great defensive line will be able to get?
Always. The defense relies on the pressure. Now, keep in mind, and I believe that defensive line leads the league in sacks. I'd be surprised if they don't, because they have three guys with over 10 sacks or 9.5 sacks. It's the best four-man rush in football, it looks like, this year. But they've had a lot of coverage sacks, too. And I don't say that as a disparagement to Jerry Hughes or Mario Williams or Marcell Dareus. That's a compliment to that secondary. It's a very good defense top to bottom, and they play well with, you know, unit to unit. They sync up well. They play well together.
Yeah, they do have that top-ranked sacks. I'm impressed.
Oh, because I knew the stat?
Yeah, without even looking.
Well, I do watch games. You know, I watch games. I hear
it's
what
your
announcers
mental
say. And I remember it. And you can just kind of get a sense for that after, I mean, you watch the film. You're going to see they're getting a lot of sacks right now.
All right, let's get to it. Here's Jerry Hughes with Andy Benoit.
Talking with Buffalo Bills defensive end Jerry Hughes. And, Jerry, I put you on my midseason All-Pro team for the MMQB and for the Sports Illustrated, the magazine. And since then, you've played even better. So, you know, thank you for making me look good.
I appreciate you having me on the team, man. Good luck.
Well, I want to talk to you about your win and the Buffalo Bills win last week. And I'm sure you've been asked plenty about your fumble recovery and the touchdown return. And that was obviously a turning point in the game. But what stood out to me watching the film and that one was you going up against Joe Thomas and some of the inside pass rushing moves you did against him out of a wide nine technique, out of a wide nine alignment. Can you talk a little bit about that and what goes into those sorts of pass rushing moves when you're attacking inside from such a wide position?
Yeah, I mean, it's just something that we kind of work on over here, just given the certain call that's predicated from the defensive coordinator. He kind of gives us a call. I mean, it's a technique that we kind of just been working on throughout the spring, and it's just I'm just, you know, taking the drill and just putting it on the field there.
Talk to me about, so obviously, and that makes perfect sense, because when you're doing something like that, when you're covering as much ground as you're covering, that's got to be part of the scheme, because otherwise we're talking about gap control issues and your teammates got to know where you're going and what you're doing. When the coaching staff decides to make those kind of calls and you attack inside a lot in a game or in a sequence or something, are you aware of why the calls are made? Do they tell you, okay, we're going to do this against Cleveland and here's why? Or do you just work on it during the week and the calls are the calls and you don't think about the why?
Yeah, the calls are the calls and really don't worry too much about the why. I mean, it's the scheme of the defense. It's what they see fit to kind of help us win the ball game, so everyone kind of just chimes in and just does their part.
Right, it's the coach's job to worry about the why. In other words, that's why they probably don't go home from the facility some of the nights.
definitely.
I'm sure many are thinking that this is your breakout season, but you actually played very well last year in Mike Pettine's system, and so heading into this year, I was really curious to see how you would play in Jim Schwartz's more traditional 4-3, because it's a similar system to what you were in as a Colt. And then, as I'm sure a lot of people know, things didn't work out great there in Indianapolis with you. How have you been able to transition into such a good 4-3 defensive end now at this point in your career?
I mean, I've always been a defensive end, even dating back to college. So, I mean, just really just going back to where it all started from, I mean, I kind of learned the game of football from a defensive end standpoint. So, I mean, that it was really like just going back home. I mean, the technique, putting my hand back down in the ground and things like that, I mean, it's just second nature for me.
How are you a different player now versus what you were in your first 2 or 3 years as a pro?
Probably just a lot smarter or a lot more knowledgeable of the game, understanding, you know, the ins and outs of how you're supposed to prepare to be a pro and how to really just take care of your body so you're able to kind of go out there on Sunday and, you know, have that finished product and things like that, which I think was a great testament to just being around guys like Robert Mathis and Dwight Freeney and just watching how they were able to be so successful year in and year out and just see for myself, you know, from a first-hand point of view on what they did to be great.
there have been games this year, your Buffalo Bills, and I remember specifically like in the season opener against Chicago's one example, where you guys had a high volume of blitzes and different disguises or zone exchanges often, not necessarily blitzes, but you changed up with a variety of tactics throughout the game. And then as the season's progressed, and especially last week against Cleveland, it was a lot of straightforward stuff, cover two and just lining up and playing. How different is it on your end of things when it's a high volume, multiple type of game plan versus just lining up and playing out of a straightforward look?
I mean, it's really not too much of a difference because we're still going forward and we're still attacking. So we still kind of have that attacking mentality. We just take that and just throw a couple of schematic things in there to kind of just critique it and make it look good.
Is there any difference in the preparation part in the days leading up to the game? Because I often wonder, and I'm sure you guys do lots, I often wonder, though, like when I watch a team that plays cover two an entire game or a lot of a game, what did you do during the week? Because you weren't having to install a whole bunch of different packages. So what were you able to work on during the week instead?
Just working on communication, making sure everyone's on the same page as a defensive end of the whole. Because, I mean, you have to kind of be on the same page when you're playing against, you know, an elite quarterback like a Peyton Manning, like a Tom Brady, because, you know, those guys will most certainly find whoever's not on that right page and exploit them. So with that being said, I mean, for us, week in and week out, it's just communications and then us being able to kind of talk over crowd noise and then just work well as a cohesive unit.
And that's something people don't think about. As a defender, you guys have to fight crowd noise at home with your communication because the crowd likes to get involved in that end of things. I remember Zach Thomas one year complained about the Dolphins' home crowd noise because they had so many signal calls.
Right. I mean, for us, it works in our favor just because, you know, the offense likes to communicate and talk a little bit more than us. So, I mean, for us, that works volumes for us just because of that crowd noise. They might lose a word or two in a complete sentence of a play call for us. I mean, we're able to just shout two or things out, and then just how we prepare week in and week out, we're just starting to become more used to that crowd noise and that high level of decibels.
Jerry, get you out of here on this question. Is there anything that positive that's happening on the field with your team right now that people are not noticing?
Yeah, we're winning games. I think we've put together two great solid wins, and I think for us it's just keeping that momentum and just keeping the ball rolling. So I think for the most part that's just probably not getting enough attention. But, I mean, for us we're fine with not getting attention. We just got to keep doing what we're doing and just taking it one game at a time.
And that Bills-Broncos game is in the 4 o'clock window from Denver. And rounding out the AFC West, the Raiders this week host the 49ers. Given the rumors that have popped up about Jim Harbaugh possibly being traded across the bay, Andy, just for fun, we normally don't go with this angle. What would this Raiders team look like if they had Harbaugh as their leader?
I think they'd look pretty similar to what
pretty Raiders like.
Yeah, I Raiders like. You know, he was on the staff for a little while there.
Yep.
Years ago, before anybody touted when he was trying to learn to be a coach. Before anybody was touting Jim Harbaugh. I don't think it'd be that much different. I don't think Oakland's problems are coaching related. I haven't, I guess I haven't been in those meeting rooms and all that. But and I'm not saying it's the best coaching staff in the world that they have, but you know. Often NFL teams' issues are not as much about the coach as people think. The good teams, though, that have great coaches, you can see an impact there. But I don't think there are a lot of coaches that go out and lose games for their teams. There might be some that can't win the games, and that might sound very similar to people, but there's a difference between can't win the game and lose the game. There aren't actively bad coaches in the league. So to ask, you know, how would it look different, I don't know if it'd be that much different. Now, Harbaugh is a very good coach. So he would be an upgrade if he had his staff over there in Oakland, but I'm talking circles around something because I have no answer for that kind of
thing.
Like I just don't know.
A lot like the Seahawks, though, the Niners don't have a lot of rope left. You pretty much have to win out if you want to get into the playoffs, catch the Cardinals, or grab a wild card. Do you see them being able to do that moving forward, starting with Oakland?
Well, I do see them starting with Oakland and doing that. What's their record again? Is it 8-4? Is that correct?
They're 7-5.
Oh, they're 7-5 because it's right after the Thanksgiving loss.
Oakland's 1-11. If you forgot,
they ought to be like 1-15 after last week's loss. Last week's loss to the Rams ought to count for 4 or 5 in the standings because there was 4 or 5 games worth of points that they gave up to that team.
That was nasty.
I'm gonna watch a film on that later this week. I can't wait because when it's a blowout like that, the film's usually very crystal clear, and usually we'll only have to watch half of it because teams eliminate their game plans after halftime. It'll be a fun week.
That makes your day.
I don't know
a
the answer
easier.
To your Niners question, man. I'm sorry, I don't know. I go back to film. I can't wait to watch film.
Well, you watched the Seahawks-Niners game. What jumped out at you about the Niners that maybe showed some problems or good things, even with only scoring 3 points?
Well, good things with that. Their defense. That front seven's pretty good. It's, you know, Borland's still playing well.
Hope's having Alden Smith back.
Yep, and Brooks apparently has decided he wants to be a part of the rotation after all with Aaron Lynch, and that's gone just fine. They've been good on that side, and they're good up the middle. So it's that's encouraging for San Francisco, but that offense, Kaepernick has so many inconsistencies to his game, and the wow factor is real with him, and teams do fear it, but you know, and it's another topic for another time probably because I don't want to just drop a Kaepernick bomb in the middle of this and then go to the next game, which is what we're about to do. But Kaepernick's inconsistencies stand out, and we really see it against good defenses. We're not going to see it this week as much, but we'll see it next time the Niners bump into a good defense.
That Rams team that did hang 52 unanswered points on Oakland last week goes on to Washington. We haven't actually talked, believe it or not, about RG3 getting benched. Andy,
yeah, because he got benched right after we recorded.
Right. So we still haven't been able to get at that. You agree with this?
Yes, I agree with it wholeheartedly. Because let me tell you, if you don't bench RG3 with the way he's playing now, then you're telling your locker room as a head coach that there's something more important than winning.
You
going
said
on.
The same thing about Austin Hill, too, with St. Louis.
Yes, Austin Davis.
Austin Davis.
Yeah. Austin, well, Sean Hill, because they're the same guy. They just switch. They flip flop every few weeks.
Exactly.
So, it's you can't tell your team that winning's anything less than number one on your list. And when you're playing a guy, look, John, there were plays where 5 Washington receivers were open on routes in the same play. 5, which is that's the most you can ever have. And RG3 wasn't pulling the trigger. There were plays where the primary read wasn't open. He wasn't pulling the trigger. You can't play football that way. You'll lose the locker room. You'll lose the other guys. How can you ask guys to play hard if they go out and play hard and then you don't allow them to be in the best position to succeed? You can't do it. Jay Gruden, I felt, had no choice.
So then you're just moving on with Colt McCoy trying to salvage a couple of wins here to end
the season? I think you're going out each week and trying to win a football game with the best guys you can. And right now, that guy is Colt McCoy. It will not be next year. I don't think it'll be Griffin next year either. I think Griffin, 4 years from now, will be a journeyman backup quarterback in the league.
Wow.
That's what I think that's...
I mean, I guess if I think of it...
That's what his level of play is. He was only dynamic. You know, he was dynamic as a rookie. I don't want to mitigate that. I shouldn't just say he was only dynamic when people... I was about to say when people didn't know him and they weren't used to him. But I think there's a little bit of truth to that as well. That read option came in 2012. We hadn't seen anything like it. He was lightning quick. Well, that's all changed now. Teams have seen the read option. Defenses have adjusted. They don't even run it anymore because he can't run the same way. And by the way, he still can't throw from the pocket consistently. And that was always the case, but it was masked by the play action system that Shanahan put him in. It's not going to last. He'll be a journeyman backup QB if at the rate he's going now.
Two teams on opposite ends of the spectrum here in the league. Bucks and Lions in a glaring mismatch here in the trenches. That Lions D-line coming in and this shaky Tampa front.
Well, yeah, shaky's, I think, putting it kindly. I have been really unimpressed with the Bucks offensive line this year, in part because they have players, at least on the left side, in theory. They paid Anthony Collins a bunch of money. They brought in Logan Mankins. They've both been significant disappointments. And then on the right-hand side, you know, the rest of that line, I mean, it's you got Dotson, you got Omema, and Evan Dietrich Smith at center. I mean, those are all 3 replaceable guys. Those guys would not start for most teams. And they've actually been okay at times. But it's not a talented group on the right, and it's an underachieving group on the left. And it seems like they take turns making mistakes, individual breakdowns. It's just, it's been a very bad offensive line this year, frankly.
The Lions did get a win on Thanksgiving against the Bears. We were wondering about some of the offensive struggles that Detroit has had in the last couple of weeks, not being able to score.
Yeah,
Are those solved?
It looks like it. I think they'll be solved for this one because the Buccaneers, last I checked, were also a cover two and cover three-based team like the Bears. And as I wrote in the MMQB column this week, the least predictable thing that we've seen all year, the least surprising thing we've seen all year is that the Lions defeated the Bears with in-breaking routes and zone coverage. I mean, the Bears just, you can't play zone coverage, that kind of zone coverage, against Calvin Johnson and Golden Tate, and especially Calvin Johnson and Calvin Johnson. And so we're going to see more of the same because the Bucs aren't going to become a man-to-man defense in 1 week.
474 total yards of offense last week for Detroit.
Yeah, that's good. I would have guessed a little bit more, actually, because they had 207. If I remember, they had 273 or 4 passing in the first half.
But the Bears are a bad team. That's a bad defense that they're going up against. Those two losses against Arizona and New England aren't just vapor now.
For Detroit. Well, yeah, but I mean, it's a 1 week at a time league. John, didn't you hear Jerry Hughes in the interview?
I did hear that, but like you said, things don't just completely change, though.
No,
just because it's 1 week at a time doesn't mean if you do something good 1 week, all your troubles are gone.
Well, no, but if you play this, I mean, they're playing a Tampa team that's so similar to Chicago. I just don't think there's a lot to discuss here or worry about. We'll have other Lion discussions at other times, but all signs point to this being a comfortable win for Detroit. I'd expect them to win by 10 to 14.
Another one of those lopsided offensive line, defensive line scenarios, the Jets and their front five on the road facing a Vikings front four that's actually pretty good.
Yeah, it is good. And Everson Griffin has had his best season, and I'm glad to see that because I've been championing him as a breakout guy for a few years now, and I guess you're not really a breakout guy if it goes over a few years, but he's an extremely gifted player, and I think he's becoming a smarter football player. Sharif Floyd's starting to show a little bit of that first-round talent that he's flashed, and then I like that you had those double A-gap blitz concepts now with Mike Zimmer in there because that creates more favorable matchups for them.
The Jets,
and Anthony Barr can blitz out of those looks, too. He's a good blitzer.
And the Jets have allowed the third most sacks in the NFL, but it's only one worse than Minnesota. So Minnesota is facing an equally challenging test with a D-line.
Yeah, because the Jets have a good defensive line, although I don't know if Muhammad Wilkerson will play in this game or not.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. And he didn't play on Monday night. I wasn't necessarily surprised by that. If he doesn't play, then that's a different story. It's hard to know because we're still relatively early in the week, but it's a different story with that Jets D-line if Muhammad Wilkerson is not in there.
Yeah, according to NJ.com, Wilkerson isn't likely to play this weekend. The Jets might not actually be the worst team in New York, believe it or not, by the time this season's over. Andy, we're about to see the Giants slip and fall to the point of Tom Coughlin getting fired. Is that possible here?
Maybe. I don't think that should happen. But if they get fired, it won't be because they had a bad year. I mean, that's obviously a big factor, but they'll feel like it was just time for a change, time to start a new era. But I would argue that they already did that by bringing in Ben McAdoo to run the offense because Coughlin does not run that offense. He's an old receivers coach, so he understands offense, but he doesn't run the offense, and they turned that over to McAdoo. So what would you do with McAdoo if you fired Coughlin? McAdoo would probably go as well because the new head coach would put in his own guy. I don't think you do that. I don't think you can abandon ship like that. And I don't think Tom Coughlin's lost the team or lost the locker room. I can't speak to that, I guess. I'm not on the inside, but I'd be shocked if that were the case. Tom Coughlin has hardware now. I mean, he's a Hall of Fame coach.
Don't their troubles come from the defensive side more? I mean, yes, 7 losses in a row, but this isn't all on Ben McAdoo. That's an offense or a defense rather that's been allowing a lot of points.
Well, it's a defense that's thin in the secondary because of injuries. It's thin at linebacker and really not great at linebacker to begin with. And then its pass rush has dipped off for whatever reason. And there's a fascinating discussion to be had about why the Giants' pass rush has dipped almost every single year since the NASCAR years for them. And one theory I've had with someone really close to this team who would know is that when you're a pass rush, you have to be at 100% strength in order to thrive. So, like, Michael Strahan has to be 100% of Michael Strahan.
One full unit.
Well, no, not just that, but, like, the players have to be their best selves. Yeah, yeah, sorry. Umanyora had to be his best OC Umanyora. Like in the Super Bowl years, Umanyora was 100% OC Umanyora. Now with the Falcons, he's probably 60% OC Umanyora. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do.
So you have to have those 100%ers. And when they drop to 90%, because of the nature of the man-to-man combat and a bunch of other factors on the defensive line, when they drop to 90%, that's a gargantuan drop. You've got to be great, really great, to be an elite pass rush. You can't just be very good. And so that's the theory, maybe, is that a lot of Giant players over the years have gone from 100% to maybe even just 90%, but collectively that's killed them. Now, on the flip side, to give someone some perspective, and this is probably true with running backs too, by the way, this whole concept, this 100% thing.
100%
yourself. Yeah. But a position like a tight end, for example, like a Heath Miller, who's probably 90% of Heath Miller after the knee injuries, and he's a little bit older, that's not a big deal because there's different demands on a tight end like that. Now, maybe Jimmy Graham would be different, but there's, you know what I'm saying? It's, if you're plugged into a system and there's a system that can support you, then it's fine. But with a pass rush, with a four-man pass rush, there's no system to support you. You are the system. It's based on you winning and beating offensive linemen. You're not a blitzer. You're not a cover guy that can have safety help. You're rushing the passer. So that's just a theory. That's a long answer to the Giant question. No, don't fire Tom Coughlin because his guys aren't 100%.
And the Giants are taking on a 1-10 Titans team this week, so maybe this is the week that they break that streak. Last week, the Giants lost to a 1-9 Jaguars team. They were able to get their second win of the season. The Jaguars are now hosting the Houston Texans. Andy, how is it that Ryan Fitzpatrick throws 6 touchdowns in his first game back since being benched?
I don't know. I haven't.
It's Fitz magic, man.
Fitz magic, yeah. I have, you know, he shaved the beard, and a lot of people reminded me that I'm glad he did, and I am, because I tweeted earlier in the year, I don't think it's appropriate for a quarterback to have a lumberjack.
You got your wish.
I know that sounds like I'm goofing around. I'm serious, though. It just doesn't feel appropriate to me. Beards are fine. I have one, in fact. And beards is
a great beard.
And I would be a great quarterback if I played. So beards on quarterbacks are fine, but you can't look like Brett Kiesel. I don't know. It seems weird. So maybe there's something with that. I know the analysis here is really trailing off, but it's frankly the Texans and Titans aren't playoff teams. So at this stage of the year, I can't get to that film until the weekend, pretty much. So I won't know till Saturday on that one.
Even you said Fitzpatrick deserved to get benched when he did for Ryan Mallett. Granted, Mallett is out now, but do you still feel like that was the right decision after that 6-touchdown game?
I'd have to watch the film, but yeah, because no, I wouldn't have to watch the film because the decision. I had this argument with Matt Gagne, my editor this week, actually, is when do we?
I bet you fight with editors a lot.
Gagne, yes, yeah. when do you critique decisions? And my argument is you always got to critique them at the time they're made. You can't go and retrospect it. Not that Gagne was arguing that. That's not fair because obviously you can't retrospect it. But it's, yeah, at the time, Fitzpatrick had not played well. So, of course, the decision was a good one just because he comes in and throws 6 touchdowns.
AFC
and,
Offensive Player of the Week?
Yeah, well, whatever. You can't, in hindsight, you can't go back in hindsight and say, well, it was a bad decision to bench him because we didn't know he'd throw 6 touchdowns at the time he was benched. All we knew was that he had played very poorly those first several games.
Can you believe that Panthers-Saints has playoff implications this week?
For both teams.
Both teams. There's talk that Rob Ryan is not getting along with Sean Payton and could be out as defensive coordinator after this season. Would that be justified?
I would say no because I think he's done an okay job, for one. Keep in mind, Rob Ryan electrified this team last year.
Yeah, but at the beginning of this season, you were saying it looked like the defensive play calling was just randomized.
Well, I wasn't saying the play call because I wouldn't criticize a guy's play calling because I don't know what goes into the play calling. I'm sure I said that somewhere.
Maybe I said that.
I'm sure there are a lot of people that say that. I just don't feel comfortable doing it because I know these
Fair
coaches
enough.
Have so many factors that are out of their control. An example would be all of your safeties blowing out their knees, and now you're having to play
Jerry's
a guy
Bird.
Like Pierre. Yeah, Jerry's Bird's gone. All of a sudden, you're playing Pierre Warren, who you sign off the street. And, you know, he actually played very well against Pittsburgh, just to put that on the record. I would not fire Ryan because I thought he was great last year. He doesn't forget how to coach in 1 year. Maybe the personalities don't work. That would be a reason to make a change. But if we're talking about just on the field, I think he's good enough to keep his job, certainly. And you know, when they're at their best, people think of these Ryan brothers as blitzers, and I think Rex is. When Rob Ryan has had his best games and they've won when they weren't expected, it's often been him going to coverage-based concepts. And I remember a great example was Cleveland against New England a few years ago. I don't remember what year exactly. I think it's 2012, I want to say. Whatever it was, when Ryan was with the Browns, you know, that was a coverage-based game. That kind of reminded me of that this week because they played all coverage against the Steelers this past week, and it went really well.
Him and Sean Payton were jumping and hugging. I don't see him going anywhere anytime soon.
Because they jumped and hugged?
Yeah.
Yeah, winning is a great way to cure a lot of it's always the solution.
The Monday night game features another NFC South game with the Atlanta Falcons on the road at Lambeau to take on the Green Bay Packers. Are the Packers now the toughest team to beat in football?
Yeah, no question. No question. And the Falcons, you know, they had a convincing win against Arizona last week. It's not going to be as easy this week, obviously. I was real impressed with Atlanta's defense. That's encouraging to me. They're starting to play better on defense. The guys that were not playing as well are now playing better, and the guys that were playing just fine have not tailed off. It's a guy like Paul Worrell who has improved his play as an example. One guy, another guy, Babineau, has started to flash lately, and he was not flashing early in the year, and he's always been their best player. So the Falcons' defense, I feel encouraged by that defense, and then on offense, you know, Julio Jones. He deserved Player of the Week award. I don't know what – I mean, Fitzpatrick, that's nice. He threw 6 touchdowns against a bad Titans team. Julio Jones won that game against Patrick Peterson and the Cardinals.
What do the Falcons have to do to hand Green Bay that first home loss of the season?
Oh, boy. I think what Mike Nolan does on defense has to create a turnover. He's going to play – my guess, I hope he plays aggressive, which is where he is – that's what he likes to do. And he plays real aggressive. He'll drop Corey Bierman back to free safety just to get a more athletic guy in the box and hope that they don't throw deep on his defensive lineman in center field there. That's super aggressive there. That's a risky approach you're taking, but he's willing to do it to try to get playmakers up near the ball. And I think he has to do something like that against Green Bay. I don't think you can just sit back and face this Packer offense man-to-man or zone-to-zone or whatever, you know, mano a mano, because you don't have as good of players as they do. And also, the Falcons don't have a very good 4-man pass rush. So you can't just sit back. They have to play on the attack.
Which of these teams has the better receiving core? I mean, Julio, like you mentioned, had 10 catches for 189 last week.
And he can do that any week. And they were contested catches, and they came against Patrick Peterson, who's not been as good this year, but is still an elite cornerback.
Yeah, and was calling out Julio during the week.
Oh, was he?
I want Julio. Julio.
Okay, before the game. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Well, he got Julio.
Yeah. Checkmate.
Ooh, the better receiving core.
It's got to be Green Bay.
Why?
Jordy Nelson, Randall Cobb, and Devontae Adams is coming up.
Yeah, but...
I love
that. Okay, but I can list guys too. Roddy White, Julio Jones, and Harry Douglas. I mean, that's a pretty good 3-man front as well there.
Roddy White isn't what he used to be. I mean, he's just still big body.
Yeah, but he's not washed up. He's not pathetic.
So you would take Atlanta?
How do you do this? I mean, do you go Atlanta head-to-head? Do you take who do you take, Julio or Jordy Nelson? I think we both take Julio Jones, correct?
Correct.
Second is...
Though I think Jordy Nelson is very underrated.
Well, not anymore. He's on the cover of SI a few weeks ago.
I think he's a top 5 wideout.
You know, Bill Simmons, how he used to say some guys are so underrated they become overrated because everyone says they're underrated.
Yeah, that's right.
I think Jordy Nelson, I don't think he's overrated, but I think we're all aware that he's underrated and therefore he's not underrated. The second receiver is Roddy White versus Randall Cobb. Who do you take there? I think we both take Cobb.
Yes.
And so that gets down to Harry Douglas and you're gonna. I think Douglas is more polished at this stage, but I would take Devontae Adams. So maybe you win the argument there. If you throw tight ends into it, you still win the argument because Corliss is a little bit better than Toilolo.
And Rodgers had a good game last week.
Rodgers is not a wide receiver. Richard Rodgers.
Yeah, you
Richard
were throwing Rogers. In tight ends there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, okay, fine. But
you did that to yourself.
Thank you. What's he got? Like 2 or 3 catches on the year, though.
Yeah,
I thought he looked good. I remember in week one watching him because he started in week one because Andrew Corliss is a bad practice player, so he always loses his job coming into the season because he looks so bad in training camp, but he winds up making the team, you know, making the starting lineup later. Rodgers started in week one against Seattle. I was real intrigued with him. I thought he'd become something for him. I still think he will. I think he's their third round pick, isn't he? He's something. Yeah. So, yeah, okay, you win the argument. Richard Rodgers was the deciding piece.
And we're ending with that. I won the argument. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Just search MMQB Podcast. We'll be back next week. From Andy, I'm John. Thanks for listening.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.